Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn about the almost forgotten simple herbal remedy effective for cancer and more. Sleep deprivation. Probably 80% of the American population are not getting good sleep. New research, you can end up with schizophrenic symptoms if you're not getting a good night's sleep. A healthy lifestyle adds years to your life, University of Zurich. Doing something is better than doing nothing for most people, a new study, University of Virginia, and much more. Always cutting-edge information. I take a great deal of time each day selecting the most important news stories from independent quality scholarly research that you're not finding in the mainstream media. Then environmental issues and updates. We'll have a lot today, including genetically modified salmon. Well, it can breed now with trout and harm our ecosystems, so says a lot of scientists. We also were told that, well, crude oil, it's important, we need it, and it's not a problem for our environment. Really? Well, why is it that when we looked at records 1975 through 2013, we found that you had more oil spills, just this year than you did in the last 40 years? We'll explain and give you an idea of why this whole movement is bad and why we have to do something about it. Also, I have a lot of short commentaries today. Half of college grads are working jobs they don't require a degree for. Then why are they doing it? I'll talk about that. A vaccine researcher charged with felony crimes for research fraud. Well, is that common? You bet. He faked AIDS vaccine data. My guest in the second part of our program is Professor Emeritus Michael Chovsudovsky. He is Professor Emeritus, University of Ottawa. And we're going to talk about the U.S. accountability for the violence and crimes being committed in Ukraine and America's intentions for a new Cold War. Happy days are here again for the military-industrial complex and all those hundreds of thousands to millions of people from the best and brightest schools from Harvard and Yale and Stanford. They would be proud of you because you're doing exactly what their curriculums and their psyche provide you with, a sense of entitlement to reap the rewards of being greedy, mindless, insensitive, and lacking anything representing a humanistic value. But in Washington, D.C., those are the exact credentials that get you into the right jobs to meet the right lobbyist. We'll talk about that. Pure poison, aluminum adjuvant linked to breast cancer, autoimmune disorders, and more. Well, where do we get this aluminum? Well, we get it in chemtrails. Chemtrails, are they real? Oh, yeah, they're real. You get it in vaccines as well. And the entire Unitarian Church votes to divest from fossil fuels. That's a good thing. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. I was sitting in an airport. I'm out on the road for another 6 weeks. And then I'll be coming back. My hope is that we will have finished, ready to air and premiere for a week at a theater in New York and Los Angeles. And for our listeners on the West Coast, I'll be out there for a week in Los Angeles, giving a lecture each night after the film on poverty. Been working on it for a long time. And we have over 100 hours edited. I have to edit it into an hour and a half for presentation. But then it's going to be a whole 52 one-hour part series. We'll be releasing one every week for either on the internet or through possibly cable. And I'm always traveling right now and filming. But I'm also running into people in airports, especially where I'm on PBS television stations, Atlanta, Denver, Seattle, Portland, all over the country, Dallas. And a woman came up to me recently, and just about 2 weeks ago, and I was sitting there and I was writing, and she said, "Are you the fellow I see on television talking about health?" I said, "Possibly." She said, "Yeah, I recognize the voice and the face." And she said, "I just want you to know that I was not into a healthy lifestyle, though I certainly wasn't intentionally into a bad lifestyle. I just didn't know about gluten. I didn't know about dairy. I didn't know about fish, farm-raised fish. I'd eat tilapia almost all the time. I didn't know about any of this stuff. So could you imagine how many of us there are, people who don't intend to make bad choices, but we do because we just don't know the details? I got your book and watched your videos, and now I've made radical changes. My friends all think I'm a health nut, but I have seen," and then she listed all the things that had changed. She said her skin is tighter, that she has more energy, that her nails are harder and pink instead of fungus. She said her hair is coming back in its natural color. I didn't ask her, but I'm guessing she was in her mid-60s. She said that she's lost about 15% body fat in the last 2 years. And she said her blood pressure is normalized, her blood sugar is normalized. She had high blood pressure and high blood sugar. She says, "I don't take any medicines now. My doctor says I'm ideal health." And she said, "Well, I'm just making lifestyle choices." She said, "So it does make a difference. I just wish more people would be aware of the message." She said, "But for those of us who do have the message, it's saving lives, the people we care about." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, my husband wasn't into this. He thought it was a fad. He thought it was like one of those infomercials that you see that make promises. And he didn't realize what that coffee every night was doing to him. Now he actually sleeps through the night. He didn't realize that his prostate didn't have to be enlarged. He didn't realize that he had to have a pot belly. He didn't really, all this stuff he just took for granted. Now he is really an advocate of healthy living. And we are also advocates within our church. And we have a small but growing health support group within our church. And what we do is, where we used to bring cover dish dinners that were unhealthy, we're bringing healthier things to a cover dish dinner." And she said, "I had a chance after reading one of your articles," and she said, "I must have downloaded and shared 1,000 of your articles." I said, "Well, I haven't, you mean mine or ones that are on my website? I've written close to 700 articles, but there are thousands up there from other people." She said, "No, I really like the one on fish, because who knew all that stuff went into farm-raised fish?" And then I saw the pictures of the ones from Alabama where we get, and she said, "I was just horrified." But you don't see it, and hence you're not aware of it. She said, "But it's spreading." I said, "Good." Now, that's the kind of feedback I get all the time. This is from the University of Zurich. Quote, "Live longer thanks to fruit, an active lifestyle, limited alcohol, no cigarettes. This is the conclusion of a study by public health physicians at the University of Zurich, who documented for the first time the impact of behavioral factors on life expectancy in numbers. The results are to be taken over into prevention and healthy counseling in primary care." What they're saying is this: cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and chronic respiratory disorders, and the non-communicable diseases that are rising, this is due to the lifestyle choices. It's not genetics. So when you impact by changing your lifestyle, like this woman, it's just an example, and in this case they had 16,000 people that they followed for 30 years, it found this tremendous difference. So for those of you who have thought, "Well, it can't be, you know, can't be that much good," it is. Every choice you make will have a consequence sooner or later. Just ask yourself, what consequence would you like from the choices you're making? Now, that gets to another issue. In my travels, I'm able to do a lot of lecturing, and I'm getting more and more younger people at the lectures. In fact, recently, if you watch the video, it's up on our Facebook page, and we want to thank the 14 million people who came there in the last month. 14 million, you'll see that most of the people who were at two major demonstrations that I helped lead, they were young people. And these are people who are in not just a demonstrating against genetically modified food. They're supporting an organic, healthy lifestyle. Most of them are vegan. They exercise, they meditate, do yoga. They're conscientious about the environment. In other words, once you take a step into making a right choice, getting realigned with the right choices of life, the next step becomes easier, the next one easier, until one day you're not even thinking about the choices you're making because you're just making good choices. You're coming from your intuition. And when you make a bad choice, you suddenly stop. An example, at a recent retreat, a person who was not a part of the retreat but was doing some work was invited to the meals and juicing and did. At the end of the week when he left, he came over to me and said, "I just want to let you know, my family is from Mexico, and we have," and he went through what his mother makes with grease and pork and sugar and all this other fried stuff. And he said, "You don't offer any of that. You offer healthy food." He said, "It really made me feel different." And then on the last night, I went into town with my friends, local friends, and we ate at a Mexican restaurant. And I want to tell you, I was sick all night long, not because I was poisoned, but my body had rejected the bad food. I didn't know that the body has that kind of intelligence. I said, "Yeah, your body's communicating. Every cell's communicating every second of every day. Tens of trillions of communications per day. So when you get used to making the right choices, you're turning on DNA that help you survive and thrive. When you make wrong choices, you're turning off that same DNA, and you're going to suffer the consequence. So you're going to immediately see the results when you start to live healthily and then try to go back to the old ways." It's just two interesting things about lifestyle. But in any case, a lot of people come up and ask just very basic questions, such as, doing something is better than doing nothing for most people. And a lot of people don't know what to do because they feel almost overwhelmed by the circumstances of their life. This is in the University of Virginia. Quote, "Most people are not just comfortable in their own heads, according to a new psychological investigation led by the University of Virginia. The investigation found that most would rather do something, possibly even hurting themselves, than doing nothing or sitting alone with their thoughts." This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Science. This was a series of 11 studies where they found out, quote, "Those of us who enjoy some downtime to think likely find the results of this study surprising. I certainly do, but our study participants consistently demonstrated they would rather have something to do than have nothing other than their thoughts, even for a very brief period of time." Okay, now, what is the takeaway message from this study, series of studies? Here's what it is. And it's relatively straightforward. What we have is we have two generations of Americans, which is a lot of Americans, who are simply out of touch with their essential and authentic needs, meaning what they need as a human being to thrive and survive in the world we live in today. And as a result, many of them have identity crisis. They just don't know who they are. They know what they do. They know the grades they've gotten in school. That they're fine on. But if you ask them to talk about who they are as a human being, you would find out they have a lot of problems with that. What is the meaning of their life? They can't figure that out. What should they master in life? They can't figure that out. So they distract themselves. Facebook and Twittering, these are distractions. Liking a gazillion people, this is a distraction. Sitting alone, quietly, introspectively, mindfully, terrifies them. Hence, this study shows, the 11 studies, they'd rather hurt themselves. They'd rather engage in some completely supercilious, superficial, destructive process, either as a voyeur or as a participant. Hence, you start seeing more and more of the extreme videos on the internet, the extreme violence, the extreme risk-taking. Why? Why do that? What comes from that? Is it a better world because of what you've just done? Are you happier because of what you just said? No. It's as if there is no life force that is being acknowledged. So the person has no authentic primal chi. There is no authentic energy that's being allowed to exist. Instead, what we have is an artificial construct, a conditional epigenetic energy that is loaded with doubt, fear, loathing, rage, insecurity, lack of trust, and a sense of betrayal. There was no unconditional love and guidance. They were pampered, babied, love bought with gifts and toys and credit cards and cars and everything else the person wanted, tutors, but no sense that the person was a real person, just an object being moved through a process artificially, like on a conveyor belt, but a gilded conveyor belt, depending upon a person's circumstances, or a ghettoized conveyor belt, depending upon a person's circumstances. And then one day a person wakes up and they don't have an idea who they are. When you don't know who you are, you're never going to make a good choice. More often than not, you're terrified of that deep, aching loneliness, needing to connect so you connect with what is most popular at the moment. And unfortunately, at this time in our society, they're not connecting with those who've understood what they should do and who they are and are doing wonderful things. I feel sorry for these people. They're to be helped, not condemned. Don't confuse the foolish, stupid, vile, and frequently inhumane actions of people who are out of touch with their spiritual self, with the spirit that has been dormant in it, waiting to awaken. It is our responsibility as human beings who are awakened to remind those who are not, there is another option to life. And that's why, before you give up on people, give it another try. By the way, I just turned in my new book on this very topic. It's a big one, over 900 pages. Hopefully, that'll help some people as well. And finally, sleep deprivation can cause schizophrenia symptoms. This is from a scientific study that found that 24 hours of sleep deprivation can lead to conditions in healthy people similar to symptoms of schizophrenia. This was done at the University of Bonn and King's College London. And, okay, this was published in the journal Neuroscience. So what they're saying is you could end up psychotic in temperament, where you lose contact with reality. You can hallucinate, you can be delusional. You can end up with schizophrenic-like symptoms if you go too long without sleep. All right, that's an obvious no-brainer. What happens, however, when you don't go 24 hours, but you only get a short number of sleep because you've been up texting, you're sleeping with a cell phone under your pillow, you're jolted by caffeine and sugar? What then comes? Well, how about the same? It's just it's not called schizophrenia. And then you go to school, and now you're diagnosed with ADHD. You don't have ADHD, but you do have sleep deprivation. So just one more reason why we should be doing more to get a good night's sleep. By the way, years ago, at the very beginning of my career, I met a nurse and a physician who both worked with the original nurse who was using ESSIAC, ESSIACT, to help people, mainly in Canada. But there was one physician who treated John F. Kennedy. He was the president's physician, using ESSIAC as well. And there's some resurgence now of interest in ESSIAC. And ESSIAC is not just for cancer or persons with AIDS. It's extremely beneficial on many different levels. And when you examine each of the herbs that Rene Cassia used, you find out that it helps the immune system rebalance, helps the pH of the body, and doesn't cost much. Comes from sheep sorrel, root powder. That's one of the primary ingredients. but there are other herbs as well. Don't try to make it yourself. It's a little complicated. But for those of you who have chronic fatigue syndrome, Epstein-Barr virus, hepatitis, BNC, herpes, cancer, AIDS-defining illnesses, get yourself into the hands of a good herbologist or homeopath and ask them for the original Essiac tea formula. And you can get it. They're four herb formulas, and they're really good. Okay? Back in a moment. By the way, tomorrow I'm going to talk about 9 reasons to stop drinking pasteurized milk. From the environmental segment today, genetically modified salmon can breed with trout. This is from Richard Gray of the Telegraph. Genetically modified salmon can breed with wild trout to produce a new fast-growing fish that can harm natural species. So, we know that those genetically modified salmon can get out of their enclosures. We know that they can breed with wild salmon. We know that this hybrid grows so fast and so large, it would compete for food with other salmon, or in this case, trout, and decimate the species. This is from McGill University, Department of Biology, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. Pure Poison, from Christina Sarich, Natural Society. Aluminum adjuvant linked to breast cancer. Quote, why you need to worry about aluminum? Quote, this is from one of the journals. The evidence warrants serious consideration of reducing human exposure to aluminum, end quote. Now, aluminum toxicity, this audience knows, has been linked to Alzheimer's. There's more. This is from a double-blind study. Quote, a detailed mechanism of the role of aluminum in oxidative stress and cell death is highlighted. The importance of complex specialization chemistry of aluminum in relation to biology has been emphasized. The debatable role of aluminum in Alzheimer's disease and crosstalk between aluminum and genetic susceptibility are also discussed. Finally, it is concluded, based on extensive literature, that neurotoxic effects of aluminum are beyond any doubt, and aluminum is a factor in Alzheimer's disease, cannot be discarded, end quote. So, how about aluminum in Gulf War illness? How about aluminum in multiple sclerosis? How about aluminum in Lou Gehrig's disease? How about aluminum from chemtrails? Yes, aluminum oxide, along with barium oxide and other toxins, are in all these chemtrails. And while it's true that aluminum is naturally present in forest soils, it's locked up in aluminum silicates, not sprayed, injected, or rolled onto the body as aluminum salts and adjuvants in our deodorants. Quote, from a scientific peer-reviewed journal, the metal kills all roots first. This means that trees can no longer absorb and transport needed nutrients such as phosphates, calcium, magnesium, essential fertilizers that are themselves leached away from the soil by acid deposition. The trees are weakened and can be invaded by insects or pathogens or succumb to extremes of weather, all of the above, in which case they die. End quote. Aluminum is also present in almost all the children's and adults' vaccines. And they say it's to boost the immune system. They're wrong. It is possible that aluminum is even more toxic than thimerosal, which contains mercury and is added to vaccines as a preservative. According to a study published in Current Medical Chemistry, children up to 6 months of age receive 14.7 to 49% more aluminum from vaccines than the Food and Drug Administration's safety limits allow. Aluminum has now replaced mercury as many vaccines, including hepatitis and the human papillomavirus vaccines. Now, why exactly is aluminum added to vaccines? It comes down to money. Aluminum is added to vaccines in order to boost the body's reaction to the antigen, meaning the virus or bacteria that causes your body to make antibodies, your natural immune response to foreign invaders. If your body's antigens are increased, then less antigen has to be used by the manufacturers of the vaccine, which makes them less expensive. So that's how we're getting it. Get rid of all the antiperspirants with aluminum, And also look carefully at all the ways that you've gotten it in your body. Chelation and horsetail herbs. Horsetail. Drinking a silica-laden water is also a good way to detox from this. And silica does not just seem to be doing this with aluminum. It also helps alleviate symptoms of dementia, according to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So aluminum is detoxified by horsetail, and it can help alleviate osteoporosis symptoms. That's the latest on those. And finally, on our environmental segment here, this is from an original McClatchy piece. Quote, from federal data showing locations, dates, and amounts of oil spilled from 1975 to 2013, quote, it says that within the past year, and indeed the past few months, North American tracks have experienced a number of high-profile, in some cases fatal, crude by oil derailments, explosions, and spills. And it goes through all these different spills, how many millions of gallons were released with each spill, how many people affected. So just keep this in mind the next time we hear about how we don't have a problem with crude oil and how it's transported around the United States by rail. Yeah, we do. The statistics there is just not being talked about. Also, we congratulate the Unitarian Church. Why? Because, according to a church spokesperson, the 2,000 delegates in attendance at the General Assembly, the Unitarian Universalist Association, voted, quote, overwhelmingly to support a fossil fuel divestment business resolution. Quote, we private citizens in private and nonprofit sectors need to take matters into our own hands and use every strategy we can to convince the government and public at large of our planetary emergency and that we must act now. So, they are divesting their $175 million endowment to 200 companies, and they're putting it into better things. Good for them. I wish they did that all over the place. I'm Gary Nall. We're talking about the issues that makes a difference in our lives. In a moment, we're going to call our guest. Just a quick announcement here that one of the things that I try to do is help people who are trying to make lifestyle changes. I only counsel those people who are terminally ill. In other words, in order to get to see me, you have to have a letter from your doctor showing everything orthodox medicine can do. It's done. And now they're advising hospice care. And that's when I go to work and try to help you. But all the other people who aren't at death's door, they need help also. So I've hired people who give free counseling to people by the thousands, tens of thousands. We've helped people. And I've just, about a month ago, brought another person on board. His name is John Alizio, and he has a master's degree in human nutrition, University of Bridgeport, a very good school. He has a BS in health sciences and nutrition. He's worked in the industry for quite a while, and he specializes in helping guide people in the choices for diabetes, losing weight, energy, poor digestion, defective immune systems, high blood pressure. Those are the areas where he helps. So we welcome him along with all the others. If you'd like to get some free counseling, there's no strings attached. Call and John will set up a schedule. You have to be in person. Call 212-874-4000. 212-874-4000. Ask for John. And he'll schedule you, and it's free. And this way, all the people who need that guidance and possibly can't afford it will get it. And get it at no charge. I pay these people a really nice, more than living wage, so you don't have to pay them anything. At least this way, everybody gets help, from the terminally ill to those who want to change their life and health around. John at 212-874-4000. He's the newest person we brought on board. Let's now see if we have my guest on board. I believe he is. Let's go over now and say hello from Quebec, Professor and Professor Emeritus at the University of Ottawa in Ontario, Professor Michael Chofsky. Nice to have you with us today.
Good morning. I mean, good afternoon.
He is the founder of the Center for Research on Globalization at the University of Montreal. He is also the founding editor of Global Research, and he is one of the world's leading visionaries in economic trends associated with free market globalization. And having identified over 15 years ago many of the problems in global neoliberal economics that are now frequently in our headlines, such as austerity, economic shock therapy, the association between rising poverty and the pillaging of developing nations' resources for the greedy. He is a challenger to the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and he's written several books, most notably The Global Economic Crisis, as well as Towards a World War III Scenario. His website is Global Research. Is it .ca?
That's correct, globalresearch.ca.
Good. Well, it's nice to have you with us today. We're hearing all kinds of various interpretations about the symptoms, meaning the violence, the rebellions, the killings, the bombings, the economic sanctions and threats involving the United States and Russia over the Ukraine. And there's no question now that the United States has helped orchestrate the installation of a neo-fascist and criminal regime in the Ukraine. The new leader, Poroshenko, has made it very clear with his statements and actions against the Ukrainian Russians and minorities who do not bow to his presidency in the new government. However, what nobody is really asking in the mainstream media is why. Why is the U.S. supporting regressive, oppressive individuals and forces in Ukraine? Why have we entertained Ukrainian radical leaders who are completely antithetical to principles of democracy and social justice? And what is the ultimate long-term mission and goal that the U.S. and its Western allies supporting Ukraine fascism and a new Ukrainian state hoping to achieve? And why is, in the geopolitical chess match between the U.S. and Russia, is the Ukraine considered so important to the U.S.? Could you please take your time and share your insights?
Well, essentially, what the United States and its allies are seeking is to extend their sphere of influence into Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. This is a process which has been ongoing since the Cold War. If we look at the history of what happened in Ukraine in the last few months, we have the installation of a government which was brought to power through a coup d'etat. It was not a democratically elected government, following the events which were described as the Euromaidan, the so-called protest movements, which were heavily integrated by neo-Nazi brown shirts, including what is referred to as the right sector. And subsequently, there was a presidential election, but that presidential election occurred through in the wake of the demise of a legally elected president, which was President Yanukovych. Essentially, what the United States and its allies implemented was regime change. A legally elected president was demoted from his seat as head of state. A coalition government was formed, and new elections were called, and the runner-up, well, there were two candidates, and both of those candidates are instruments of Washington. So that essentially what has been installed is a proxy regime, but that proxy regime is now very much relying on neo-Nazi formations They do not constitute a majority in the coalition government. It's essentially two parties, the right sect and Svoboda. But they exercise control and authority over the armed forces, the police, and the National Guard. And they are also supported by the United States and its allies. And I should mention that, in fact, the CIA has supported neo-Nazis, or Nazis, in fact, right through the Cold War era, since World War II, under what was called Operation Nightingale. Well, Operation Nightingale during World War II was a German operation of co-opting the Ukrainian nationalists. And I won't go into the history, but what happened is that in the wake of World War II, the United States maintained its links to Ukrainian nationalist groups with a view to destabilizing the Soviet Union. And so that there's a history of support of neo-Nazi groups, and in the current situation, those neo-Nazi groups are firmly supported by the Western Military Alliance, their military advisors, their people who are involved in training, recruitment. And so I think what is important for people, you know, in America, Canada, and Western Europe is to understand that Washington is supporting neo-Nazis. And then we have to ask ourselves, how do we qualify, how do we identify people who support neo-Nazi formations in the Ukraine? And these neo-Nazi formations in the Ukraine are in turn responsible for atrocities committed against the civilian population in eastern Ukraine. And in fact, the government has adopted the neo-Nazi discourse, because the National Guard, the same thing as the U.S. National Guard, which in the case of Ukraine depends on the Minister of Interior, well, it bears the Nazi emblems on its uniform, okay? And so you ask yourself, what would happen if the U.S. National Guard had Nazi emblems? It would be a national scandal and crisis. But in Ukraine, it's the new normal. The United States supports the National Guard. It finances the National Guard. And then it releases these neo-Nazis in eastern Ukraine where they are involved in the massacre of civilians.
Thank you for that insight. Should we not forget, think of the one man, Chalabi, who is a criminal, a convicted criminal, who looted $100 million from the second largest bank in Jordan and then fled. We, the United States, allowed him to come, and for a number of years he was the head of the Iraqi National Congress in exile, and hundreds of millions of dollars from our CIA, our State Department, wealthy neocons were given to him. He was brought into the White House. He met with Dick Cheney constantly, and Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. He was the person who was supposed to go in and replace Saddam Hussein. And after we got rid of Saddam Hussein, this is all before the actual invasion. And then it all went bad for him. Now he's back, and yet we forget what kind of people we promote. We forget the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. We forget the people that we've supported in Uganda. And hence the Clintons decided not to call Uganda a massacre till the very end and do nothing about retributions towards those who were responsible. We forget the war crimes that were committed by the United States under Clinton in Bosnia and Yugoslavia. We pay no attention to the crimes that we committed for over 30 years in Central and South America. In Chile alone, 30,000 disappeared and killed, all because we were involved. And the leaders of these countries were our friends. Look at Mubarak. For 33 years, he was an open door to the White House and Congress. He was hailed as a hero. Look at Netanyahu. Look at all the people around the world who run tyrannical regimes, engage in various systematic campaigns against their own people. So why should we be surprised that the head of the government now in the Ukraine is acting as like a Nazi would? Why should this come to a surprise to us?
Well, it shouldn't necessarily come to as a surprise, because for people who have been investigating these things, as you mentioned, U.S. foreign policy is predicated on supporting precisely terrorist formations, whether it is the ISIL in Syria, which are the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance. They're paid, they're mercenaries, they're recruited in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, or whether it's the neo-Nazi right sector in Ukraine. What they have done is to support terrorist entities which then contribute to destabilizing and destroying sovereign nations. And we can look at the various so-called civil wars across sub-Saharan Africa. They're called civil wars, but in effect, if we start to dig, we'll realize that they're the result of foreign interference. I mean, we can point to the wars in Sudan or Rwanda or the Congo, for that matter. But, I mean, historically, the United States has committed, I'm talking about the U.S. government, its military, industrial appendage, of course, the financial interests which support it. It has been involved in countless atrocities going back to the early post-World War II period when we had the Korean War. Now, during the Korean War, we know, because these are figures which are even acknowledged by the United States, that up to 30% of the population of North Korea was literally killed and wiped out, and the whole country was destroyed. And the irony, the bitter irony of this, is that people in America don't know that, and then their government tells them that North Korea is a threat to global security. Okay? Now imagine a country which has lost 30% of its population, confirmed by General Curtis LeMay when he said we must have killed 20%, but he didn't. That was over a certain period, but he acknowledged it. Okay, so that we are, and then we look at the atrocities committed in Indonesia, where up to a million people who allegedly had links to the Communist Party were liquidated, men, women, and children. And what is occurring in Ukraine is part of a pattern. You mentioned Central America. Well, we know that in Central America, John Negroponte was involved both in Honduras and Nicaragua in setting up death squads. And who do we appoint to the embassy in Iraq? John Negroponte, who was there responsible to set up death squads in Iraq, together with Robert Stephen Ford, who later was appointed ambassador to Syria. So there's consistency, there's history, there's consistency. And I think what is important here when we talk about neo-Nazism, people in America have very strong opinions against Nazism. And they should now understand that their government is supporting a neo-Nazi National Guard, and a neo-Nazi government in Ukraine. The Prime Minister said that the Russian-speaking Ukrainians are subhumans and that they should be eliminated. And that discourse has barely... It's mentioned in alternative media, but it is not acknowledged by the New York Times, which describes Ukraine as a flowering of democracy. Well, that flowering of democracy in the eastern part of the country is characterized by the systematic killing of civilians, not military targets. It's schools, it's power plants, it's apartment buildings, it's public buildings, deliberately targeted by the Air Force, and then, and that's, I think, another dimension, the United Nations Human Rights Office in Geneva, headed by Commissioner Navi Pillay, comes in and makes a statement that both sides in the conflict are to blame, and essentially says the people who are resisting this neo-Nazi government, and they're not solely Russian, okay? They're Ukrainians. Ukrainian and Russian is almost the same language. It's like saying, you know, Texas and California. They speak differently, but and they are together. There's intermarriage. So it just so happens that there are more Russian speakers in the East than there is in the West. But it's incorrect to say that this is a rebellion solely by Russian speakers. It's by people who reject this neo-Nazi regime and who have formed self-defense units. But now when you look at the United Nations, what do they do? They go in with a monitoring mission. Their narrative is also written in the U.S. State Department, and they very explicitly come up with a report where they say both sides are equally to blame. Okay? In other words, the neo-Nazi death squads are sent in with the armed forces and air force, and the people who are defending themselves are then accused of... In fact, they're accused of killing their own children. It goes to that extent. Children are killed by aerial bombings and shelling of homes and apartments and so on. Of course, children will be killed. But they even go to the extent of insinuating that the self-defense groups are killing their own children, when in fact... The evidence amply confirms that this operation in East Ukraine was ordered by the government of President Poroshenko.
Here's the issue for me, and I'm sure many people listening right now. What is the actual motive of the United States and, by extension, the American media? Because the American media has not covered this honestly and objectively. Independent media has, but not the American media. And also, in looking at Ukrainian President Poroshenko's current strategy, it appears to follow a plan in a confidential document generated by the RAND Corporation a couple years ago. It's a course of action in Ukraine, which includes military and mop-up operations, which are going on now, and procedures to completely cut off and isolate Ukrainians in order for the regime to perform its dirty work. Now, Michael Hudson recently called the International Monetary Fund for the Ukraine a weapons of mass destruction, which will decimate the Ukrainian economy, except for the kleptocrats and their financial interests running the government. And since the Ukraine is perhaps the largest economic basket case in all of Europe right now, it is inconceivable that it would be allowed into the European Union. And already we're witnessing France and Germany taking steps towards better relations with Russia over the Ukrainian crisis. Therefore, what is the primary motivation for the International Monetary Fund, with the U.S. behind it, to put the Ukrainian situation in a tight straitjacket and austerity? The suffering will get worse under all the plans currently offered by the United Nations and the International Monetary Fund, all of it. And yet, is this about colonialization of the Ukraine by Western corporations? Does this have to do with profits, massive profits being seen? Does this have to do with NATO being able to put NATO forces and armaments on the Russian borders? Does this have to do with a new Cold War ideology from the neocons that live, sleep, breathe, drink at Fox Network? What's this about?
Well, this intervention in Ukraine has an underlying economic objective. Ukraine is a breadbasket. It's the largest, among the largest producers of grain in the world, together with the Midwest of the United States and Canada. It has an industrial base. It's a large, relatively large country with a population of over 40 million people. And essentially the conquest of Ukraine is an economic conquest. There's oil and natural gas, there are pipelines, there's the whole geopolitics behind the pipeline routes from Russia to the European Union. And in many regards, historically, Ukraine has been a buffer state. Ukraine means border in Russian. It's essentially a border state. Its frontiers have changed over the years. Now, if I go back and look at the IMF program, the IMF has been active in Ukraine right from the outset. That is in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and in 1994 they implemented a devastating set of macroeconomic reforms, which led to an overnight increase in the price of energy of 900%. Okay, it was called shock treatment. And what they also did was to open up the borders of Ukraine to the dumping of EU and US grain surpluses with a view to destabilizing the breadbasket. And how do you destabilize the breadbasket? Well, you first introduce these hikes in fuel prices, which literally paralyzes the economy, and then you liberalize trade so that there's no way in which they can compete. And they've done that in many countries. The population of Ukraine has been impoverished over a period now of more than 20 years. If we look at the post-Cold War era. And I think, as Michael Hudson correctly points out, there's an economic agenda. There's an issue of acquiring wealth, acquiring control over financial institutions, and so on in Ukraine. And this is also implemented by integrating Ukraine into the European Union through this historic agreement, which was turned down by former President Yanukovych. There's no doubt that the IMF medicine, which has been imposed in a financial package, which has been signed and approved by the various parties, is going to impoverish the Ukrainian population beyond bounds. But I should mention, this population is already impoverished. So that we're in a scenario of social destitution where people's lives are literally destroyed. And you can well imagine that if the price of basic commodities and fuel has already gone up, I think this is just the beginning. And as soon as people across the land from east to western Ukraine realize that their lives are going to be shattered as a result of these macroeconomic reforms, the protest movement which has emerged in eastern Ukraine could well spread to the west. And there's, despite the attempts to divide people, there's a certain solidarity across the land. And the people in the east are not necessarily against people in the west, but they are against the attempts of their government to create divisions between them. And of course, there's a lot of rhetoric, there's political rhetoric which is behind this, but certainly the IMF program with the process of debt repayment and so on and so forth is going to be devastating. I should mention, and it's very important, is that when the IMF grants, an $18 billion loan, because that is the order of magnitude of the IMF's pledge. That money is fictitious. It doesn't exist. It goes from the IMF into the pockets of Ukraine's creditors, so that in effect it never enters the country. It does not contribute to the country's development, but it is a safety net for the Western creditors of Ukraine, which are able then to cash in. And with the debt repayment process, the country then has to accept what are called conditionalities, IMF conditionalities, which are very stringent, which imply not only freezes on wages, increases in energy prices, curtailment of old age pensions, and so on, but also a privatization program, which will affect the major state corporations of the country.
Well, we see, from my perspective, I see this purely as the efforts to artificially create a third world economy for the people of Ukraine. That's the consequence for the first world economy's profits and geopolitical needs. Thank you very much for your contributions today on this. You've given us a lot of good insights, and people should go to the website globalresearch.ca and read the book, The Global Economic Crisis, or The Dangers of Nuclear War Towards a World War III Scenario. Thank you very much, Professor Michael Chofsky, for being on with us today.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program. Bye-bye.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. We look forward to sharing more tomorrow.
Stop right.